In 1956, Mr. Armstrong wrote these words, "The Germans are coming back from the destruction of World War II in breathtaking manner. Germany is the economic and military heart of Europe, and probably Germany will lead and dominate the coming United States of Europe, but Britain will be no part of it." In 1973, right after the British joined the EU, he wrote, "Britain is going to look back on Monday, January 1st, 1973, in all probability, as a most tragically historic date, a date fraught with ominous potentialities. For that date marked the United Kingdom's entry into the European community." And that was in the March 1973 edition of The Plain Truth. In fact, Mr. Armstrong said many times that Britain and the English would not be a part of the coming superpower of Europe, and that they would someday leave the EU. He was right once again, even though he's been gone now for 30 years, his words still ring true. From Ken Murray, received this from Ken yesterday. He's a minister down in Australia, also volunteers to go up to India and Ceylon quite a bit. He says, "Until today," this is a kind of a British perspective, "until today, with the Brexit vote by Britons to leave the European Union, on Friday, 24th of June, 2016, there has not been a more momentous day in modern prophetic events than since the Berlin Wall that divided East and West Germany was finally breached by jubilant Berliners on 9 November, 1989, unifying a city that had been divided for over 30 years. Against howls and jeers from scorners, Mr. Armstrong prophesied for decades that Germany would be reunited and the Eastern Iron Curtain nations of Europe would come down, which were then under the USSR iron fist. Silence was deafening from our critics in 1989 when that biblical prophecy was fulfilled. Similar to today, we have the British voting to leave the EU. As of 24 June 2016, we're witnessing a great prophetic milestone becoming a reality." So what will be the biblical consequences of Britain removing itself from Europe and closing its borders to its European neighbors? Will it possibly try to reunite with its old Ephraimic Commonwealth of Nations, or perhaps something else? So we will see what occurs, but certainly the Brexit vote took most of the world by surprise and caused an earthquake of reaction all around the world. From the British Daily Online, they wrote, "Yesterday, as dawn broke over a shocked Brussels, a group of European ministers of parliament warned that last night's astonishing Brexit vote will cause the EU to crumble to pieces within the next 5 years. Their statement came as Britain voted to leave the EU, contrary to all predictions by pollsters, to the bewilderment of the Eurocrats in Brussels. This is the beginning of the end for the EU, Peter Lundgren said, far-right Sweden Democratic Party member. So many other countries will follow the UK, and Europe will fail or will fall. Of course, the EU was put together not by a strong, charismatic leader, but by a bunch of bureaucrats who wanted to have a single currency, have trade encouraged back and forth between nations, not have borders, so anybody who was in the UK could then come into any one of the EU could then come into any country without having to show a visa or a passport as they crossed the lines from one country to another. And of course, those open borders, we have seen many effects of that as people from all over the Middle East and other parts of the world have flooded into Europe and then have easy access up into England. While only a few of the pundits on the news have had the courage to recognize is that this vote was essentially a reaction to the flood of migrants from the Middle East coming into the nation of England. And, of course, the average Englander saying they did not want their country taken over and turned into Sharia law or some other occupation. The ones we saw, I try to watch BBC News if possible because it's a little more accurate and has much less of a slant than the American news. I just don't have much faith in American news being accurate. But everybody they interviewed on the street pretty much said they were tired of the immigration, tired of the invasion, and they simply wanted their country back to the way it was. So we will see what the eventual outcome of this is. Certainly the stock markets have been going down around the world. Yesterday the U.S. stock market lost 600 points. and around the world, most of them lost somewhere between 4 and 8%. Continue reading here. The French leader Marine Le Pen also changed her Twitter symbol to the Union Jack in a sign of how the Brexit will increase the support for the far right in France. In France, Sweden, Germany, Italy, and France said a number of governments now will be under intense pressure to hold referendums of their own and try to negotiate their own individual deals. This, I said, will lead to a domino effect in the wake of Britain's trailblazing and unprecedented decision to leave the EU. Now, as I wrote in the pastor's message this week, the European bureaucracy is an absolute jumble of crazy regulations. You have to go, you can go online and look at EU regulations sometime if you'd like a good laugh. But they are just unbelievable. They have regulated farms to where the farmers almost can't produce or make a living. They have regulated virtually every aspect of business and of commerce and of the production of almost everything. They've even taken over the production of airplanes because the airplanes they produce there are basically an EU-produced airplane. And, of course, as anybody in Seattle will tell you, they are inferior to Boeing airplanes. And then most of the pilots I've talked to that flew both of them readily agree with that. They want to fly Boeing products. They don't want to fly the European-produced product. But nevertheless, the EU has for many years been able to produce their own currency. And, of course, what's happened when they've produced their own currency was the average person made it more difficult to make a living or to pay their bills. The EU, when the euro came into Italy, my cousin there mentioned that everything seemed to double in price overnight and that the actual out-of-pocket money they had to spend went down to almost nothing. At any rate, let me continue here. The minister from Sweden said the EU cannot survive. It is too undemocratic. Corruption is too high. The bureaucrats' ambition is too much. There's too much money in the gravy train. It makes the average person mad. And, of course, I think that's happening in our state and in our nation, just not quite as fast yet. Overnight, it has become apparent that Britain was turning against the EU establishment. Brussels bureaucrats gradually left the bars around the Parliament building and went home to bed. It was a tremendous shock. People had faith in their polls that thought the Remain movement would win by about 1 million votes. They ended up losing by about 1 million votes. The next section mentions how it could spread. Sweden polls have consistently shown that a majority of Swedes want to stay in the EU. However, considering what happened in Britain, they may have also a vote there. France, they're have been movements in France to get out of the EU for a long time. Italy, certainly, the populist five-star movement vowed it would demand a referendum. In the Netherlands, they've been wanting to have a referendum for a long time. Of course, the Netherlands has been really targeted by the waves of Muslim immigrants from the Middle East, and they feel they could conquer that country and take it over as the first nation in Europe to go completely Sharia law or Muslim. Quite a lot. There's just a lot of things here, but the London stock market was down 8%. The Remain camp is distraught. You'll see that if you were watching the news, you probably saw a number of people who were basically going into a full-bore panic over what happened. So Italy, of course, many people are there want to get out of the EU also. So we'll see what happens, but certainly the winds of change are blowing across the globe. And who knows what might happen in the U.S. here in the next 6 to 8 months. Certainly we will see. The last article here mentions that France, Netherlands, Austria, Finland, and Hungary all have movements to leave or already have scheduled elections to possibly leave the European Union. It's a momentous time because we are waiting now for the European community to do whatever in history and in prophecy we know must happen before the return of Jesus Christ. I want to begin today by going to Daniel chapter 12. Daniel did not understand everything that he was told, the prophecies that were given to him, the visions that were explained, the dreams that were explained. He passed on the explanations to the kings or to others. But when he asked for himself, well, what does this mean about the time of the end and this time and half of times and the power of the holy people being completely shattered? What do all these things mean? And the angel told him, well, guess what? You don't get to understand because you're going to go your way. You're going to spend your time in the grave and you will awake at the end with the others who are going to be in the resurrection. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 8, he says, although I heard, I did not understand. So typical, because God only allows certain people to understand. Jesus Christ said in Matthew 13, blessed are yours, you've been given understanding of the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not given. I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time at the end. Now, by the time of the end, he says, many shall understand. The wise will understand. So the words in Daniel's book here are closed up and sealed until the end time when many wise will understand. Notice, many shall be purified and made white, and that may be the entire time between Daniel's time and the return of Jesus Christ, or it could just mean that section of time there right before the end of all this society as we know it. Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly. We certainly see that continuing on and increasing as every year goes by. But none of the wicked shall understand, and they certainly don't. But the wise shall understand. So this prophecy that Daniel requested to understand, Daniel says or records for us that the angel said, in the end time, there will be wise who will understand. And so that is what we are trying to do, is to understand the big picture of what is going on, and indeed that God is still in control of events here on the earth. I want to go back now to Isaiah chapter 46. It's important that we understand that God is in control, that none of these things are happening without his involvement and certainly his acknowledgement, his approval. As we have seen evil rise, wars and rumors of wars, and the moral degradation of the Western societies, those who were at one time Christian societies, kicking God out of every institution and certainly making passing laws and national policies in defiance of God's laws. We've seen those things happen. We know that the events prophesied politically will happen very soon beyond that. Isaiah 46 and verse 10 mentions, let's start in verse 9. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. God simply says, I am the only God. There's no other like me that can predict events from now until in the future. He says, I am God, there is none other like me, declaring the end from the beginning. So from the very beginning of times, he has declared what the end was going to be. From the ancient times, those things that are not yet done. So he said, from ancient times, long before Isaiah, God said he prophesied things that will be yet in the future from Isaiah's time, saying, my counsel shall stand, the words of God, the prophecies of God shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. I will do all my pleasure for my purpose. Calling a bird of prey from the east. Bird of prey here symbolizes a nation that would be used to punish his covenant nation that has turned against him. The man who executes my counsel from a far country. Indeed, I have spoken it. I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it. I will also do it. So he's simply reiterating this prophecy that he will use a bird of prey or a man, an individual, to someday punish and bring to their knees the nation that has turned against his covenant, the covenant with him. Let's go over to the book of Daniel now. I think it's important as we try to get a big picture that Daniel tells us some very important principles. In fact, the book of Daniel is the foundational book of prophecy in the Bible concerning the role of Gentile nations and concerning the panorama of world history. The book of Daniel simply is the foundation. Without it, it is not possible or would not be possible to understand Revelation and even some of the prophecies that Jesus Christ quoted, and certainly a number of places in Isaiah and Ezekiel. In Daniel chapter 4, we have Nebuchadnezzar the king, who is writing a letter after he had been returned to a man's status because he had been bragging, and of course we've seen that where he was cut down. The prophecy from Daniel about his dream was that Nebuchadnezzar would be cut down like a stump, but his roots would stay alive, and then for 7 years he would wander as an animal and then be brought back as a man and restored as king of Babylon. So in chapter 4 and verse 1, he says, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell on the earth, peace be multiplied to you. So this time he is still the king of the first world ruling government, all peoples, nations, and languages. He knew that his territory was very large and included many nations and many different languages being spoke. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. Now, there's a certain humility here that was not there previous to his 7 years of punishment. How great are his signs, how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and notice his dominion is from generation to generation. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar is saying God is in control of what happens here on the earth for every generation. He doesn't create us and then just leave us alone. He actually is in control of the way things are going. Sometimes people say, oh, things are getting out of hand or things are getting out of control. The truth of the matter is things are going according to plan. It is going according to God's plan and according to what he wants to have happen. It's just difficult from a human perspective to properly understand that sometimes. So Nebuchadnezzar is saying, I learned this lesson that God's kingdom is everlasting and that his dominion is from generation to generation. In other words, he's always in control. Let's drop down a little bit farther to see exactly how this occurred. He mentions here in verse 13, I saw in the visions of my head while on my bed, and he saw this tree cut down, and the beasts of the field had to go somewhere else. He mentions here, verse 17, this decision is by the decree of the watchers, the sentence by the word of the Holy One. So Daniel's interpreting the dream, and Daniel tells him that the Most High, or that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. Very important principles just in that one sentence by Daniel. That God gives his blessing or his authority to the living because he has control over the earth. That he rules in the kingdom of men and he gives it to those whom he will in accordance with his will. But often he sets over it the lowest of men. So often we have seen in history the basest of men ruling nations, men like Hitler, Stalin, Castro, so many others in our time, Pol Pot, and of course many, many, we could probably just keep going on, Mao Zedong, but some of the lowest of men, the basest of men, character-wise and otherwise, somehow have gotten themselves, God allows it, in position to where they can then be tyrants and abuse their fellow man. So Nebuchadnezzar then had this dream. Nebuchadnezzar, Belteshazzar, the new name of Daniel, the Babylonian given name of Daniel, gave him the interpretation. Verse 25 says, they shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, they shall make you eat grass like oxen, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven. 7 times or years shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had several warnings from God. If you look through the book of Daniel, the very powerful demonstrations of God's omniscience and God's power and God's purpose were given to him. The fiery furnace account back in Daniel chapter 3, and of course the other accounts with the image. You would think that Nebuchadnezzar would have learned his lesson, but he simply did not. There is a toxic intoxication that comes over humans when they become in charge and accountable to no one. They forget that there is a God and think that they are God oftentimes. So what happened to Nebuchadnezzar mentally, the Greeks called it hubris and some other names I think in other languages, but the hubris or the grandiose idea of yourself being accountable to no one and you begin to act in that way affected Nebuchadnezzar, even though he had several warnings from God about God's power and Nebuchadnezzar's rightful place in comparison. But it only took him about a year. Here he had this very strong warning, and a year later, he's walking on his palace. Verse 29, at the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. He didn't say, well, you know, thank God, the God of heaven who has allowed me to live in Babylon and blessed this nation and given us all these things. He says, no, the king spoke saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? He gave no glory to God. Remember, the New Testament says, do all things to the glory of God, not ourself. While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven and said, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And of course, it happened to him that very next hour. So how he was not replaced during that 7 years, I don't know. He must have had awfully loyal staff and people who watched him out there in the field eating like a cow and sleeping in the, in the grass like a sheep. And then he came back in 7 years and was restored to being king. All I can say is he must have had some very, very loyal staff and supporters. Because at verse 34, at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. So the human spirit returned to him. I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. Notice he repeats his earlier announcement. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And then he adds, all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He said, compared to God, all people on the earth, regardless of what position they hold or how many, if they're part of the 1% or the half of a percent or the 99%, doesn't matter. All inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. Later, James says, we are like grass that comes and flowers and then dries up and blows away. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. So God does according to his will, and he does it in heaven and also according to what's happening on the earth. So we have seen some powerful events this last week, but we must keep in mind our perspective that God is in charge and he is working his will among the inhabitants of the earth. To gain a strategic perspective, we need to understand that there are three major roles in prophecy. There are three major players in the panorama since the time of Adam and Eve and the return of Jesus Christ. Just to get a couple foundational verses, the first thing we need to understand is the role of the church, the role of those whom Jesus Christ is calling, God the Father is calling, giving us knowledge in his spirit. Let's go over to just verse 14. So right before the book of Revelation, the book of Jude tells us that from the very beginning, before the flood of Noah, the return of Jesus Christ with millions of his saints has been prophesied and taught. You see, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and his truth is from everlasting to everlasting, which means it's everlasting backwards to the very beginning and everlasting forwards for all eternity. So God's truth doesn't change, his purpose doesn't change, his truth doesn't change. All that changes are the generations as one group passes to another, then is born and grows up. But in Jude 14, he mentions Enoch, the seventh from Adam. So this is before the flood, prophesied about these men saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. So before the flood, the prophecies were given, the predictions were given about Jesus Christ returning with 10,000s or 10,000 times 10,000s of his saints. So the return of Jesus Christ was told, was warned to the people before the flood. Notice the purpose, to execute judgment on all, that Jesus Christ is going to return and rule from the earth and judge everyone, to convict all who are ungodly among them of their ungodly deeds. So the purpose of judgment is to convict people, bring them to repentance, to where they acknowledge they have been ungodly. Notice, which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. Now, things have been spoken against our Creator God since the beginning of sin. But perhaps in this verse, he's really referring to the blasphemous world institution known as the beast and the false prophet that is in league with the beast, that rides the beast in those years just prior to Christ's return. And we'll have time to touch on that probably next week. But notice that from the very beginning, the prophecies were given, the warnings were given about Jesus Christ returning to the earth and judging all the earth about their ungodly acts which they have committed and giving them a chance to repent. So the gospel of the kingdom of God being here on the earth has been preached from the very beginning of time. Let's go back to the book of Job. We just finished Job in our Bible reading program. The book of Job is an interesting study because it is the oldest manuscript, the oldest book, first one written in the Bible, written during a time not long after the flood, when they were a small population on the earth, and many of those people lived in tents. They were shepherds. A lot of cities were not built yet. Just simply not long after the flood, perhaps 3 to 5 generations, we don't know exactly. But this is the most ancient book of the Bible, the very first one written, certainly written long before Moses wrote the first 5 books of the Bible. Now, what is an interesting study sometime, if you would like a rewarding Bible study, go through the book of Job and find out how many spiritual teachings in Job are also in the New Testament. And the number I have, I believe, is 22. Spiritual truths found in the book of Job that are also taught in the New Testament. Because Job proves that God inspired the very beginning and also the end of the book. There are no conflicts. One example is Job chapter 19, verse 25. This is an incredible statement when you think about it. Here Job says, "I know that my Redeemer lives." He knew that he would have to have a Redeemer, have to be redeemed from sin. He knew that his Redeemer was alive in heaven. And notice, he shall stand at last on the earth. He knew about the return of Jesus Christ to judge and redeem the earth. Amazing that many thousands of years ago, the very first book of the Bible written has that incredible statement that Job knew his Redeemer lived and that someday he would stand on the earth. And then he adds this. This is very important. After my skin is destroyed, or after I'm dead and my body has decayed, this I know, that in my flesh, or I'll be resurrected back up, I shall see God. Didn't necessarily mean in his exact fleshly body, but in my flesh, or in the same consciousness or the same presence as I am now as a man, I shall see God. Same as in 1 John where he says, we shall see him as he is. You know, we'll be like him. We'll see him as he is. Notice verse 27, whom I shall see for myself. So Job knew about the need for a Redeemer. He knew about the return of Jesus Christ standing on the earth. He knew about himself being resurrected and seeing Jesus Christ face to face. He says, how my heart yearns within me. Really means for that time. So Job yearned for the return of Jesus Christ and the establishing of that kingdom. I mean, it's kind of an amazing truth. Think about 3 very powerful truths in those 2 verses that were known way, 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 way before Mount Sinai, before Abraham was called, before all of these things that people think came into being later. These truths were into being from eternity way back, just like they are going to be in eternity going forward. Well, that's just a couple of them. There are many more in the book of Job you can find that are powerful eternal truths taught throughout the Bible, but their foundation, the first time we hear of them, chronologically speaking, would be in the book of Job. So the role of the church, and of course we could spend days on all the verses, many of them you are familiar with, the role of the church is to return with Jesus Christ and to establish his judgment on all the earth, to increase his family, to be with him forever, to increase those who are brethren of Jesus Christ. That's the overall writing purpose, to be in that resurrection, to be like it says in Hebrews 11, that those all died in the faith waiting for the rest of us who would be resurrected with them. So the role of the church then is to establish a family of God, a very large family of God in the millions, to help bring the kingdom of God to this earth. If we understand that, we understand something that the world is very ignorant of. And it's a very powerful, profound truth. And we understand the role of the church then in the end time here really isn't to rule anything yet. We aren't told to go get involved in national politics or to demonstrate in the streets or to try to effect some sort of righteous change in our government. Our role is to prepare for the kingdom of God when Jesus Christ will return as Enoch prophesied, with thousands of his saints, and then establish judgment on the earth. So we understand that right now we are on the sidelines preparing. We are not major players in the events that are going on in the earth, although our job is to continue to preach and certainly to spread the gospel as much as we possibly can. Secondly, we need to understand the role of Israel. if we understand the role of Israel and the purpose of the physical tribes of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, then the rest of what we see happening around the world can make a little more sense. Let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Now, every year at the Feast of Tabernacles, we hear many beautiful scriptures about the world tomorrow and what Israel will be doing. So I won't have time, I don't need to go through all of those. But when God first called the Israelites out of Egypt, his purpose for them was very clear. And that was they were to be an example for all other nations. So other nations would learn about God and how to worship God, how to come to him, because they would see the example of this first nation that God called. So Deuteronomy chapter 4, let's begin in verse 5. Moses is relating to the people, and he says, "Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land you go to possess." So when they went to the promised land, they were supposed to obey the statutes and the judgments that God gave through Moses. He says, "Therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding," notice, "in the sight of the peoples." Other nations would look at Israel, see them and say, "Why are they blessed? What are they doing?" Who will hear all these statutes and say, "Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." You know, he didn't command them to do a lot of foreign aid, didn't command them to try to shore up governments that were failing, religions that were causing trouble. No, they were simply to be a good example and wait for when other nations would come to them and say, "Wow, what a great nation, what a wise and understanding people. We should try to follow their example." What great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? For whatever reason, we can call upon him. He is here. He's near to us. We can pray and contact him whenever we need to. What nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you today? So other nations were to look then and say, "This is the example that we should follow. This is the, you know, the real God is being worshipped here in Israel. And that's where we should be following." Let's also go over to Ezekiel chapter 37. We'll kind of get the example here of what we find and that we read every year during the last great day or the eighth day of the feast about the resurrection, this physical resurrection of the people of Israel. We oftentimes read the first part of the chapter, but don't spend as much time on the last part. But here's a beautiful description that these people will be resurrected. They will have a new covenant, and they will be brought to the land of Israel, and then finally be the example for all the earth that they were supposed to be. You know, they broke their covenant with God, and so they went through 2,520 years of penalty, punishment. But then they were blessed, like the entire earth will be blessed someday when they follow the example of Israel that they see, and they will learn how to obey God. Ezekiel 37, beginning in verse 15, says, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'As for you, son of man, take a stick for yourself and write on it, for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions.'" So one stick had to have the name of Judah on it. "Then take another stick and write on it, for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions." So the second stick had to have the name Joseph written on it. "Then join them one to another for yourself into one stick, and they'll become one in your hand." So as Ezekiel brought these sticks together in his hand, God apparently supernaturally made them back into one stick. This would have been, I think, about pantomime 23 or something. Ezekiel did all kinds of pantomimes and little, you know, cut his hair and put it in blocks and chopped it up and put on a backpack and went back through the hole in the wall. The pantomimes of Ezekiel certainly would make anyone not want to be a prophet. I just can't imagine doing some of the things these guys did. But at any rate, these two sticks were to become one in his hand. "And when the people, children of Israel, your people, speak to you saying, 'Will you not show us what these mean?'" How does it mean? What does it mean these two sticks were supernaturally joined together? "Say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God, surely I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will join it to them, and the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in my hand.'" So God says, "I'm going to bring them in my hand and make them one again." and the sticks on which you write will be in your hand before their eyes. So the meaning of that, verse 21, then say to them, thus says the Lord God, surely I will take the children of Israel from among nations where they have been scattered. So he'll bring them back from where they've been scattered. And when the second resurrection occurs, and they may be scattered, you know, all over the earth. And I will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king over them all. We know that's King David. And they shall no longer be two nations, nor shall they ever be divided into two kingdoms again. They shall not defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, or with any of their transgressions. So the promise of birthright blessings will be reunited with the promise of the scepter or the throne of Israel, just like it was under David and Solomon. And those two, of course, have been divided into two separate blessings, two separate nations, or two separate inheritances ever since Jeroboam and Rehoboam then split the nation into Judah and to Israel. But that breach will be healed. Notice verse 24, David, my servant, shall be king over them. So he was the one that united Israel to begin with, and he will unite them again, or they'll be united under him again. They shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. In other words, they will begin to obey God. They will observe God's laws and statutes. Then they that dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob, my servant, where your fathers dwelt, they shall dwell there. They and their children and their children's children forever, and my servant David shall be their prince forever. And moreover, I'll make a covenant of peace with them, a new covenant, described in Ezekiel and other places, also in Jeremiah. A new heart and a soft heart be given to them. It says, I will establish them and multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary, that's the temple that is going to be rebuilt in the millennium, in their midst forevermore. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Indeed, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And notice this, the nations, the other nations of the earth also will know that I, the Lord, sanctify or set apart Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forevermore. So the people of Israel are going to be an example nation. They will finally fulfill their purpose that Moses told them was their purpose, but they neglected it. After a very short period of time, they began to go after idolatry and turn against God. The book of Judges and certainly all the Kings and Chronicles are filled with a sort of an up and down history, mostly a down history when it comes to the northern 10 tribes. So the role of Israel will be fulfilled. The role of the church is going to be fulfilled. Lastly, the third major role to understand when reading the Bible about Bible prophecy and trying to understand really the world we live in now is the role of the Gentile nations. And that is where the book of Daniel is the key to understanding what is going to be happening in the big panorama of history from the time of Daniel in the 600s, 500s BC until the time when Jesus Christ returns. Now, the obvious place to start is Daniel chapter 2. So let's just go over to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel 2 is the foundational chapter of the Bible prophecies of the Gentile nations in the Bible. This is the dream about the large statue with the head of gold, with the chest and bronze of silver, and then the body and thigh of bronze, and then finally the legs and the feet, 10 clothes of steel, iron, and the 10 toes of iron and clay. This prophecy is foundational. The other prophecies about the four world-ruling kingdoms are all built upon Daniel chapter 2. We need to understand this carefully. It actually is fairly simple to understand because Daniel explains it. But the rest of the chapters of Daniel, beginning with chapter 7, simply give us more details, give us more kind of fleshing out what these four world-ruling kingdoms will be like and what they will do. And finally, of course, you have Daniel chapter 11 and ending on chapter 12, which tells us about this fourth or the final resurrection of the fourth empire and what the conditions will be like and some of the events before the return of Jesus Christ. So in Daniel chapter 2, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, so it wasn't very long that Daniel had been there, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. And he had this dream and he told his Chaldeans, his sorcerers, tell me what the dream is and what it means. And of course, they couldn't. That was impossible. And so he said, well, I'm going to be killing you all then. Verse 13, the decree went out and they began killing the wise men. And they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. So, you know, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a nice guy. Obviously, he wasn't just a sweet little grandpa type. If someone didn't do what he wanted, well, then he had them executed. But Daniel went to his house and prayed, and the secret was revealed to him in verse 19. And he went and told the guard who was trying to carry out these executions to stop, because notice verse what Daniel says to him. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness. Nothing is hid from him, and light dwells in him. So he went to Arioch and told him. Arioch was the name of the commander of the guard that was sent out to destroy the wise men. And they brought him to King Nebuchadnezzar. He mentions in verse 31, you, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. Now, later, Nebuchadnezzar makes himself an image, and he may have thought this image looked like him, or since Daniel simply said, well, the head of gold is you, perhaps he thought it was appropriate to build this image and have everybody worship it, which, of course, we know Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not. But to begin with, or to continue here in chapter 2, there was this image in verse 32. This image's head was of fine gold, his chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze. Its legs were iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So essentially there are five parts, not just four, because the legs are iron, but the feet then are mixed with iron and clay. You watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet. So a stone basically comes out of the sky, strikes the image on its feet, and the entire image falls to pieces and is blown away like chaff. And no trace of it was found. And that stone then, in verse 35, that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So here's the interpretation. Verse 37, you, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom and strength and power and glory. So wherever the children of men dwell, in other words, all of the known world, Nebuchadnezzar ruled over. And he says in verse 38, the last sentence, you are this head of gold. So no question as to who the first world-ruling government was. It was Babylon, headed by Nebuchadnezzar. After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. It's more of a two-headed kingdom, the Medo-Persian Empire. And a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And then finally, a fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And at that point, you know, iron was stronger than copper or bronze, which were the first two metals that were melted and used by metalsmiths. It says, like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. And he mentions here about the feet and the toes, partly of clay and partly of iron. The kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it. So the kingdom was divided east and west, or right and left, two legs. It also was divided in the strength of fact that was symbolized by clay mixed with iron. As the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. Verse 44 is where it's headed. In the days of these kings, so these toes represent kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. In other words, this kingdom would last forever. There will not be a succeeding kingdom. It will not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut without hands, and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. So this dream depicts the four successive world-ruling empires from the time of Daniel until the establishing of the kingdom of God. And this is the foundational chapter of all Bible prophecy chronologically, certainly the foundational prophecy about the panorama of world history from the time of Daniel until the time of the end of this society, really, but the time of the establishing of Jesus Christ's kingdom here on the earth. The second kingdom is given us a little more detail here in Daniel 5. Let's go over to Daniel chapter 5. And we find here where this kingdom of Babylon was almost without warning turned over to the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, who would then be represented by this chest and arms of silver. In Daniel chapter 5, there, of course, is a warning, and we have this this party going on where, just like Nebuchadnezzar, this is Belshazzar, who was, I think, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. He began drinking wine, brought out the vessels that were intended for only service in the temple, and he began to drink out of those and began to deride the God of heaven, just like many years later, somebody else is going to be deriding the God of heaven and making fun of that. They brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God. Now, here's the sidelight. This may be just pure speculation. I didn't make it up. I've heard it several times. As most of you know, when Jerusalem was conquered in 70 AD by Titus, who was the son of Vespasian, who had become the emperor of Rome after the year of four emperors, and I think the last one he defeated was it Galba? I forget. Anyway, there were four of them. That's the emperors I have a hard time remembering. Of course, they went 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, it's hard. Not like a guy like, you know, Claudius that reigned, I think, 13 years, or Nero was 11. But at any rate, here we have this massive destruction of Jerusalem, and all of the gold items that were taken out of the temple were carried over to Rome. If you've seen the Arch of Titus in Rome, how many have been to Rome and seen the Arch of Titus? When I went to Rome, there were two things I wanted to see. I wanted to see the Arch of Titus. I wanted to see the painting of Raphael that depicts Simon Magus standing by the river, supposedly River Tiber, supposedly confronting Simon Peter. Verification that Simon Magus was there, I don't think Simon Peter ever was. But you have to know where that painting is, because when they take you on these tours, they go right past it. That painting, big as a wall, it's back to probably big as that wall. But the tour guides don't think it's important, so you sort of have to know where it is. You have to look around the back way when you go up the stairs. But at any rate, the Vatican Museum, only about 10% of what they have is on display, and it is a massive amount of Roman history. I think Dr. Bacciocchi wrote at one time that, that he felt that all of the items taken out of the temple in Jerusalem were still hidden in the Vatican's basement somewhere. The big menorah, the 7-candle menorah, is being pictured as being carried out of the temple on the Arch of Titus. It's just, you can see pictures of it quite often. You look on the internet, look up the Arch of Titus, and you'll see the picture there of all these gold items and this big 7-menorah being carried out. Now, if that's the case, obviously they were carried out of Jerusalem. We know that. And if those vessels and that menorah is somewhere in Rome being stored, is it possible that when the beast power forms and when the Catholic Church relocates its headquarters to Jerusalem, mentioned in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, would they possibly then bring those same vessels that are mentioned here in Daniel 5, because they probably still have them? But would they then come to Jerusalem and do the same thing that Belshazzar or that Belshazzar did? You know, have another whatever. Would they use them in their worship, or who knows what they would do? But it's just kind of a sidelight that might be an interesting thing in prophecy and history, that if those same vessels are transported back to Jerusalem at some point in the future, they could again be used for idolatry and false worship, and perhaps the reaction would be the same. So just something to watch. There's some little things in history, that plus the, the statue of St. Peter, which isn't Peter at all, but it goes back much, much farther than he did. So it's possible that those same vessels could once again become important in history. We'll just kind of wait and see. But notice verse 4, they drank wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So they used the vessels intended to worship God, and they praised idols, gods made out of gold, silver, wood, and stone. And of course, what happened is the writing appeared on the wall, and simply said, Daniel's saw the vision there of this many, many can tinkle you farson. Let's go to verse 24 of Daniel 5. The fingers of the hand were sent from him, and was written was written. This is the inscription, many, many tinkle you farson, which means God has numbered or weighed your kingdom and finished it. You've been found weighed in the balances and have been found wanting, and your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being 62 years old. And so this transition then is from the first kingdom, the first world ruling kingdom, the head of gold, to the second kingdom, which was pictured here by the Medes and the Persians. Eventually the Persians controlled it all. They were the more powerful of the two halves, and it became known as the Persian Empire, which only lasted about 200 years. And so we have this transition then pictured for us after this banquet, recorded for us in history, and of course there are many other places in history that also mention it. Now the transition from the second to the third is given to us in Daniel 8. Let's go over to Daniel 8. We'll go back to Daniel 7 because Daniel 7 is a very important chapter giving us key details about these four kingdoms that help us to identify it but also tell us what to watch for. In Daniel chapter 8, we have the vision of the ram and goat. This is about Alexander the Great. Now Alexander the Great, after many years of the Persian Empire trying to conquer Macedonia and Greece, the Greeks finally decided, the 110 or so city-states of Greece, finally decided to quit fighting each other and to join together to try to stop the Persians. You're probably familiar with the Battle of Thermopylae in the 300, which was pathetically misrepresented in that silly movie called The 300. You think they could take something as exciting as what really happened and make it real, but Hollywood has to, just frustrating. One of several movies I've simply walked out on because it was so historically inaccurate. My wife gets mad at me at home when we watch a movie that's supposed to be historical, and I yell at the TV. She said, look, if you didn't want to watch it, just go and do something else. Okay. So we won't talk about that. But anyway, so we have Daniel chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the first one that appeared to me the first time. That's 2 years later. Remember, the first vision was in Daniel chapter 4. It was year 1. This is year 3. While I saw in the vision it happened, I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. He's up off kind of off of a tributary of the Euphrates River. I was by the river Ulai. I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns. Now this ram was the Medo-Persian Empire. You have Media and Persia together, and they made a ram, or they made a empire that was pictured as a ram here. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. So the Persian Empire became higher than the Median. And so we have these two groups, but essentially under one king, and the Persian became more dominant. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. Notice it didn't go east. It went northward, south, and west. And as it went westward, they tried to conquer the area of Macedonia and Greece and failed every time. But Darius did succeed in building a bridge across the Bosporus. I think the first one built, it wasn't replicated in something like 1926 or whenever it was when finally somebody else built a bridge there at Constantinople, or Istanbul as it's called now. But he did move his army across that bridge and attacked in Greece. Of course, Greece miraculously was saved. But eventually the Greeks got tired of all these attacks by the Persians, and Alexander was able, after the death of his father, to unite them together and put together an army and decide they were going to attack the other direction. After getting attacked for a couple hundred years, they thought, let's go back and get those guys. So verse 4, the ram was pushing westward, northward, and southward, and no animal could withstand him, no other nation. Nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And Persia did expand their territory, and as you know, they were in control of the Holy Land for many years. I was considering, and suddenly a male goat came from the west. Notice, this male goat comes from the west, from the area of Greece and Macedonia, across the surface of the whole earth. He conquers the whole area of Persia. Notice, without touching the ground. Now, historians record that Alexander left Macedonia after putting his army together and uniting the Greeks and saying, look, we have to stop after his father, King Philip, died. There are some interesting things in history about King Philip. They found his burial place and his sarcophagus, that type of thing, about 20 years ago. Nevertheless, the record of Alexander the Great was unparalleled in history. From the time he left Macedonia until the time he arrived in India and Afghanistan, his army averaged 30 miles a day. And the average army was good to make 5 miles a day back at that time. So he literally ran across all of the Middle East, all the way over to modern-day India and Afghanistan. And, of course, the only defeat he had during that time was at the hand of the Indians who had elephants. And so the Indians basically stopped him, but his army also said, we're tired of fighting, we want to go home. So anyway, Alexander the Great was this male goat in verse 5. Notice verse 6, he came to the ram that had two horns. This is the Battle of Granicus. The Granicus River was the first time. Several other battles, they very quickly put the Persians out of their place and took the country over. And they ran at him with furious power. Certainly a good description of the way Alexander fought his battles. I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him and attacked the ram and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to withstand him. And he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So this is the transition from the arms and chest of silver to the next kingdom, which was the third kingdom, typified by the torso of brass. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. That's Alexander grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. In place of it, four notable ones came up towards the four winds of heaven. Now, these, by the way, are explained in detail in chapter 11. But this chapter is very important because it was written down by Daniel. It was kept in Jerusalem. And if you read the history, notably by Josephus, and I think one other, I forget exactly who it was, that recorded why Alexander the Great did not conquer Jerusalem. He had just built his causeway over and conquered the city of Tyre, and he was coming down to conquer and destroy Jerusalem. And, of course, these are the guys that were only about two generations removed from Ezra and Nehemiah. Remember, this was in the 300s. Ezra and Nehemiah, Ezra was 454 B.C., so we're only talking 80 years after Ezra and Nehemiah came over. And, of course, before that, you had Joshua and Zerubbabel in the 500s B.C., 517. But at any rate, so the priests in Jerusalem came up with this idea to save their city, and it actually worked. What they did is they said, well, look, this ram is obviously Alexander. Our God prophesied Alexander. If we could just get to him and show him that our God gave him his power, they probably knew that Alexander was a very superstitious guy. And before he left on his conquering journey from Macedonia, who did he go talk to? Nathan, but does anybody else know? Begins with a D. It actually begins with an O. Oracle at, anyone know? Delphi. That's where they got the auto parts name, I guess. So Alexander goes up to this mountain, talks to the Oracle of Delphi, and she tells him, you're going to conquer the world. So he went down to and conquered a lot of the world very quickly. And as he was coming into Jerusalem, the priests knew that he was superstitious, so they all dressed in white. And they lined, as he was up on Mount Scopus, which is where we stayed that summer I was at the dig on Mount Scopus, it's kind of, you can see all of Jerusalem right to the south. So Alexander's camped up there. So they opened the gates of the city, and all these priests in pure white robes, several thousand of them, I understand, line this road all the way up to Mount Scopus. And they all have these big fronds, and they're welcoming, and they want to tell Alexander to read what our God prophesied about him. And he was so struck with this Daniel chapter 8 prophecy that he spared Jerusalem and, in fact, didn't do any damage at all. He just kind of bypassed it, left somebody in charge to eat and drink, and took off. And he went down to Egypt and conquered Egypt very quickly and then talked to these priests and these soothsayers in Egypt who also told him that he was supposed to conquer as far east as possible. So that's when he took off and went over to Afghanistan and to India. Now, the only reason you need to know all of that is because some people really are impressed with prophecy. If a guy like Alexander can look at the Bible and say, wow, this was prophesied hundreds of years before me, about 250 years, and maybe I should do something to obey this God, or at least to not destroy his city. People today read these prophecies, and I don't know how they just discount them, saying, well, you know, that's back then, this is now. At any rate, Daniel 8 does give us this transition from the second to the third world ruling government. Let's drop back now towards the previous chapter, Daniel 7. Daniel 7 gives us much more detail about the fourth world ruling government. I think we'll have time just to get through this today, and we'll have to continue next week. Daniel 7 is an incredible chapter when it comes to detail and comes to telling us about these governments, about these various dominant kings that would be here on the earth. In the first year, chapter 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. He wrote down the dream, so Daniel recorded it, thankfully. Daniel spoke and said, I saw by vision at night, behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Now, why is it important to understand that the winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea? What does that have to do with us today? Well, in Revelation 13, there are two beasts mentioned. Where does the first beast come from? Out of the sea. Where does the second one? He said, about verse 11, he says, I saw another beast coming out of where? Sir? The earth, the land. When something comes out of the sea, it's a surprise. You don't know what it is. We've all been in the swimming pool, and somebody swims up behind us and jumps up, surprises us. These came out of the sea because they came off up almost out of nowhere. No one would have dreamed that these fighting city-states of Greece could, within 2 or 3 years, conquer the greatest empire on the earth. The same thing with Rome, the same thing with Persian media. In the end time, the beast that comes on the scene in Revelation 13 will come out of the sea. It will be a surprise. But the man of sin, or the second beast that rides the first, comes out of the earth because it's recognizable. It's been around for a long time. The second beast is not going to be an identity puzzle. We'll know who it is because it's been around for a long time. And so an earthly institution will ride this beast that comes out of the sea in Revelation 13. And we'll talk more about that next week. So the winds of heaven, meaning godly influence, God is still in control, is stirring up the great sea, or all of mankind. And these four beasts come up out of the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, the head of gold, but it had eagle's wings, one of the symbols of ancient Babylon that continued down through Rome and even to modern Germany. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. So maybe referring to the fact that Nebuchadnezzar's spirit was taken from him. He walked on all fours like an animal, but then he became reinstated as a man, and he stood back up on his 2 feet. Notice a man's heart was given to it. So Nebuchadnezzar symbolized that first beast. Suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, was raised up on one side. It came from the eastern side of Babylon. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was a conglomeration of 3 separate nations that came together, formed Persia. And they said, thus to it, arise and devour much flesh. And of course, the Persian Empire did. After this, I looked at another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings, so it moves very quickly. Now, obviously, this is Alexander, the Greeks, who moved very quickly across the face of the earth. The beast also had 4 heads. After he died, his government was divided into four different kingdoms. He died, by the way, in the throne room of Nebuchadnezzar, in Nebuchadnezzar's own throne, which I think is really interesting that was the next succeeding power, the one after him, that he died in that throne room of Nebuchadnezzar. After this, I saw the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. So in the night, he sees visions. This fourth beast was dreadful and terrible, very scary, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth, iron stronger than other metals. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet, which Rome did. Rome was very dominant and established Roman Empire wherever they conquered. It also conquered for a much longer period of time, from about the 300s BC all the way up until about 300 AD. from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So this last beast is terrible, has teeth of steel, it expands and tramples, and then it has 10 horns. I was considering the 10 horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them. So you have these 10 horns, and another one comes up among them. Another horn, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked up out by the roots. So this horn then kind of absorbs the first 3. And of course, we know from history that would have been the first 3 resurrections of the Roman Empire, and they were put together and consolidated when the Roman Empire was joined with the Roman Church, and they became then under Justinian known as the Great Restoration. And there in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of a man, with a mouth speaking pompous words. So this concept of pompous words being spoken against God is a thread throughout the Bible, not only with the dinner of Belshazzar, where they were speaking against God and for the idols of the earth while they were drinking out of God's vessels, but also here back in the time of Justinian, and of course it will continue until the time when Christ returns. Because it says in verse 9, I watched till thrones were put in place and the Ancient of Days was seated. So this last government, this little horn that comes up among the others and becomes dominant, lasts until the Ancient of Days is seated, and his garment was white as snow, obviously a picture of God the Father on his throne. His hair on his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, that shining presence of God's glory around it. Its wheels a burning fire. Those wheels are given to us in detail in Ezekiel 1, Ezekiel 10, so this is where God's throne is. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him, and thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were open. Now, this has a parallel chapter in the Bible. At what other chapter in the Bible do we find the throne room of God seated? God seated there with thousands of angels around him, and it's time to have session in court. The books are open, and judgment is now to be given. Revelation 5. Very simple. So we have 2 parallel chapters that should be read pretty much in concert with each other, because each one gives us a slightly different perspective on what is going on. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. Notice, these pompous words irritate God. They are a reason for the judgment that's coming. The horn was speaking, I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. And of course, that's given to us in Revelation 17, 18. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So there are still nationalities, but these other nations are destroyed. Their military power is completely gone. Their lives are prolonged for a season and a time, because there will be nations still physically here on the earth. There will be people living into the millennium, just a remnant. But the kingdom of God will be started on the earth, and those nations will learn to worship God, having Israel as their example. Verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven came to the Ancient of Days. So we have the one who we know as Jesus Christ being given now the kingdom of God, the administration over the earth. They brought him near before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom. Parallel in Revelation 11, verse 15. We sing that with the Messiah. You know, the kingdoms of the earth are become the kingdoms of our God, and he shall reign forever and ever. That all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. So almost a word-for-word parallel to Revelation 11 and the announcement that the kingdoms of the earth are now to become the kingdom of God. Well, for the sake of time, we'll stop there, and next week we'll continue and kind of finish up some of these things that we must have foundational understanding of as we watch these momentous events happening in the world.